This is the 100th episode of the Dr. Geo podcast. Before we begin with our special guest, I just want to say thank you. You know, I'm humbled every day when I see the subscriber amount clicking away on the YouTube channel, over 20,000 subscribers. I am humbled when you come to my website, the Dr. Geo website, and you want to become a member of that community. You are an important member of my tribe. I spend tireless hours figuring out what information do you need to know in the world of urology and men's health, in the world of prostate cancer, for the newly diagnosed, for the man who is on androgen deprivation therapy with advanced prostate cancer, those with a recurrence, those with bone metastasis, for men with prostate problems that are benign, that are affecting your urinary function and your quality of life, guys with low testosterone and erectile dysfunction, which there again affects quality of life. Thank you so much. I am in so much gratitude to you for being such a proactive member of my community, for commenting, for subscribing. All these things matter. It matters to me because then the algorithms work in my favor and in the favor of this podcast. But most importantly, it matters because we want to get this information out to as many people as possible. We want to get this very important content out so that men can be proactive in their own healthcare. These are the self-empowered health advocates that we talk about, and practitioners who are also listeners and active participants here. Practitioners who want to get it right as it relates to all things urological health and men's health. I am, again, so touched by you all, and thank you. Lastly, I also want to thank those experts that have taken time out from their busy schedule to be on this podcast. You know, I always say that with those that I've interviewed, those that have been my guests on this podcast, I would love to have coffee with them on any given day to talk about, talk shop on their expertise. But that never happens because everybody has a life, everybody's busy. But they've said yes to me, and they've said yes to this podcast and to be on. So I am in gratitude to my interviewees and the experts that have come on and those that have yet to come in the future. Thank you so much. Today's guest is Dr. Thomas Seyfried. Dr. Seyfried is one that you've asked me to have him on. Many of you have said, when are you going to have Dr. Seyfried on? And here he is. Dr. Thomas Seyfried is a professor of biology at Boston College. He has published in over 200 peer-reviewed journals, and he has written the very popular book, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, on the Origin, Management, and Prevention of Cancer, by Wiley Press. In this conversation with Dr. Seyfried, we talk about all things metabolism as it relates to prostate cancer specifically. He definitely opened up my eyes as to the potential approaches to prostate cancer from a ketogenic perspective and the metabolism of prostate cancer, things that I was not quite aware of, at least based on the research that I read. Dr. Seyfried is a, I wouldn't say pioneer in this field of metabolism of cancer, because probably Otto Warburg was, and Dr. Seyfried chose 30, 40 years ago to bring about this research from the 1940s and open it up to possibilities on how people can manage their cancer. We focus 100% around prostate cancer and the metabolism of prostate cancer with the one and only Dr. Thomas Seyfried. Let's go. I am your host, Dr. Geo, where it is my intention and my goal to help you with your prostate health, things related to testosterone, erections, how they all come together, and how to live better with age. As you know, as my audience, around prostate cancer, and many of you have asked, when are you going to get Dr. Seyfried on? Well, your request has been answered, Siegfried, on the podcast. Tom, thank you so much. And thank you for allowing me to call you Tom. I like to respect your professional, your doctor or mister, but we're a little bit more laid back on the podcast. So thank you for being on.
We'll get a good conversation going.
Tom, take us back. Your work has revolutionized how cancer is looked at by many. Some may agree, some may disagree. But the bottom line is that many people are applying your concepts, whether they're doing it with their work or they're doing it clinically, with writing their own books on the metabolism of cancer. How far back are we talking about? What led you to probably devote your life? I don't know, prior to devoting your life on cancer, you did some other work, you had another specialty, but what inspired you to say, look, this is a good area to focus on? And let's bring back that Warburg theory on cancer that was known, during before World War II. Mm-hmm. So take us back and bring us forward as to what's the evolution of cancer from a Dr. Siegfried perspective and study and research?
Well, Gio, it's not a straight path by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
What do you
right.
think? I woke up one day and said, we're going to manage cancer effectively as a metabolic disease, and all the crazy stuff we're doing is medieval. No, right, it didn't happen that way.
Right, right.
That's where it is today. No, I mean, I have a master's degree in genetics from Illinois State University in classical mutagenic genetics. And I followed up with a PhD in genetics and biochemistry from the University of Illinois in Urbana, Champaign-Urbana. And then I did a postdoc at Yale University and then became part of the faculty there in the Department of Neurology. And at that time, Dr. Gilbert Glasser was the chairman. And he was one of the world's leaders in the field of epilepsy. So I came to Yale with the hope of doing research on glycosphingolipid function, isolation, purification, and analysis with the late Dr. Robert Yu. And he was the best in the world at doing this. And we were looking at various neurological diseases and the genetics. But he told me that if you want to stay at Yale, you better do something with epilepsy because the whole program here is epilepsy. So I started looking at seizures in these epileptic mice because I had a mammalian genetics background. And we were looking at audiogenic seizures and these kinds of things. And at the same time, we were looking at the glycolipid biochemistry and the problems, you know, at that time. And I wrote an internal grant on ketogenic diets for epilepsy. I said it might work on some of these mouse models. They, oh, no, nobody's interested in it. Ketogenic diets passe. We don't get excited about that. That was from the 1920s. So I said, all right, so I'll just stick with the gangliosides. And then we started looking at some cancer. Bob Yu was looking at some brain tumors with gangliosides, glycosphingolipids. So I started looking at retina and brain cancer and just biochemistry, just what we call smash and grab, all everything.
As it related to ketogenic diet or unrelated at that time?
Just related to the pure structural biochemistry and function of what a group of glycolipids does in the brain. Nobody knew what the hell these things did. And I quantified and isolated and purified what we call brute force biochemistry, according to traditional structural biochemistry. But at the same time, I was dabbling around in the epilepsy stuff and the MAP genes that controlled epileptic seizures. So we were doing ganglioside biochemistry. And then, of course, I had a couple of brain tumor samples. I had some mice that would develop brain tumors with some chemical carcinogens so we could get a better idea of what gangliosides might do in brain cancer. But from a pure structural biochemistry, not any kind of management or anything, wasn't related to that. I was doing what almost 90% of other people who do research in cancer is just do research in cancer. Whether it has any practical benefit for anybody, it doesn't matter, and no one cares.
In grants.
Oh, yeah.
And as long as you keep writing your papers and getting grants, who cares if it translates to, you know, improving human life.
Yeah, your goal was just to get the next grant to study yeah. more.
Right.
So, at that time I was building all these beautiful brain cancer models to understand gangliosides. And then I was an assistant professor there. And then a nice position opened up at Boston College. And I brought my entire research program up. They were very excited, you know, and had NIH and NSF grants and mapping epilepsy genes. Everybody was all excited. And then doing that for several years, gangliosides, brain biochemistry, and epilepsy. And then one of my students came to me one day, back I think in the 90s, the 1990s, and she said, oh, they're having a big meeting in the West Coast on ketogenic diets run by Jim Abrams, who was the movie maker at the time. He made the these funny movies. You know, he did with Meryl Streep, he made First Do No Harm, and then he made these Naked Gun kind of movies. They were classic funny movies. So anyway, his son, Charlie, had a retractable epilepsy. Charlie almost passed away from all the drugs and all the kinds of crazy stuff. And then he met my former colleague down at Johns Hopkins, the group Streeman, who was one of the few guys on the planet that continued to push the ketogenic diet for epilepsy. So anyway, Mariana, my student, came back and she said, oh my God, they're so interested in this ketogenic diet. And oh, you should see this, everybody. And I said, nobody cares about the ketogenic diet. The big shots at Yale, when I was there with the leaders in the field of epilepsy, said it was passé. And then Mariana told me, oh, no, there's a lot of interest in this. Jim Abrams, this movie guy, is creating a lot more interest because of his son, Charlie. Mm. So I said, okay, we'll start looking at all these mouse models of epilepsy. I said, we're looking at these genes. We can't find them. We mapped genes for epilepsy. It didn't mean anything. Then what I did is I put the mouse on the ketogenic diet. I said, damn, these all of a sudden the seizures disappear and the mice are doing well. And I said, whoa, this is really, maybe there's something to this. And sure enough, we switched. I said, it didn't make any difference what kind of mutation was linked to the epileptic seizures. When you put the mice on these ketogenic diets, they seemed to stop seizing. And it didn't make any difference what kind of seizure you had. And then we realized it was calorie-restricted ketogenic. So then I took high-carbohydrate diet and gave it in a fasting state to the mouse, and it worked just as well as the ketogenic diet. So I said, what the hell is going on with that? And the key to working was lowering the blood sugar and elevating the ketones, which was managing epilepsy. Now, we were having a parallel program in brain cancer on biochemistry. If you have two parallel programs, all of a sudden they cross paths. So, and then I said, we put some of these mice, I'll tell you what happened. It was really, really funny. This drug company came to me. They had this molecule that stopped ganglioside biosynthesis. And they were interested in knowing the mechanisms by which this new molecule, it was called N-butyldeoxyneurogyromycin. It's not relevant. But anything, almost everything that comes into my lab, we throw it either on an epileptic mouse or a tumor mouse. Well, and then we said that we gave the drug to the animal with the brain tumor, and lo and behold, it shrunk the brain tumor. Wow. So I told the drug company, because they had given us, I don't know, $5,000 or something to look at this drug. And then I said to them, you know, this drug, with this anti-ganglioside synthesis inhibitor, shrunk these aggressive gliomas in half, more than half. Well, the drug company guy who was in the cancer field, one of these pharmaceutical cancer guys, he said, just name your price. I'm writing you out a check. So he gave me a little over $200,000 back in 1996, somewhere in that area, to figure out.
Not insignificant.
Yeah. So I hired Dr. Mukherjee, who's working with me today.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah. So this was 1998. Yeah, because she started in 1998. So she's been with me all this time. And she knew about angiogenesis and this kind of thing and tumors. And I said, well, we got to hire somebody that knows something about, you know. So we started looking at this drug. And the company was all like, whoa, this is going to be a blockbuster. We get a nice drug that blocks the synthesis of these glycolipids in the brain and at the same time shrinks the tumors. This is a blockbuster. So we started giving the mice this drug. We noticed that their body weights were getting smaller, but the guys were eating. They were constantly eating, but their body weights were getting smaller. So I said to Pernicis and a couple of us, we got to put in a control group. We got to take the food away from another group of mouse that don't get the drug, but just match the body weight with the guys that eat the drug. And sure enough, the tumor shrunk just as well in the guys that got the food restriction as it did in the drug group.
So the control group, the intention of the control group was to have them not be in a drug, but not to eat anything.
Yeah, just eat regular lab chow. Because the guys that were getting the drug, we powdered the lab chow and we put the drug in the powdered lab chow.
Yep.
So we then gave the other guys just powdered lab chow without the drug.
Right.
And but we cut the chow, restricted the chow to match the body weight of the guys getting the chow with the drug, because the guys were losing body weight.
Right.
Okay. So now I had two body weight control groups, and the tumor shrunk to the exact same size as the guys are getting the drug.
And so the placebo was as effective as the experimental drug. Yeah.
So we found out later on that the damn drug blocked sucrases in the stomach. So the mice were eating the food, but they couldn't get the food, the glucose out of the food. It was not being digested.
So both groups became ketogenic.
Yes. For different reasons.
Right. So, and then you said, wait a minute, there's something here.
No, there's something here. But not only that, the drug did work. It shrunk the ganglioside biosynthesis down as well. But it wasn't that. The drug worked exactly as it was supposed to, but shrinking a tumor from an entirely different mechanism.
Right. So then what question did you ask after?
Then I said, then Perna was with me, and I said, well, what is this drug and diet doing to the architecture of the tumor? And it shrunk the blood vessels down, and it did all this kind of stuff. And at that time in the cancer field, anti-angiogenic therapies were like the biggest thing.
The hot.
Oh, yeah. They were the hot. Everything. I always say in cancer, everything is always hot, but progress towards the cure is cold as ice.
That's true. It's true.
I know. It's terrible. Yeah. It's terrible.
Unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. So anyway, we were riding the crest of all this excitement, the drug working and all this kind of crazy stuff. And then, we started looking at the tumors and then we measured the blood sugar, because we knew the ketogenic diets were lowering blood sugar and elevating ketones. And the guys that were getting the calorie restricted high carbohydrate had low blood sugar and elevated ketones. I'm saying, what's going on with that? And then we realized that Lyndon Nebling was the first one to give two little hopeless case children with that brain tumors a ketogenic diet at Case Western Reserve. She did it as a PhD student. And she said, she alerted us to the effect of a ketogenic diet might work through the mechanism that Otto Warburg had said back in the 1920s, that the tumors needed sugar. They needed glucose to grow. And ketogenic diets lowered glucose and elevated ketones. And I had been working with epilepsy for a long time, working with some of the best. And we lower, that's the way the epileptic, it works for epilepsy, you lower sugar and elevate ketones. The mechanism is not yet clear by how ketogenic diets stop epileptic seizures. Very complicated with the brain neural circuitry. But then from Warburg saying, well, these tumor cells, they need a lot of sugar to grow. So we started doing a big research on what this guy Otto Warburg, and then we realized this was the giant biochemist from the 20th century. A very colorful character, Hitler's.
Yeah, who's his Otto Warburg? I can see you. Who's his Otto Warburg guy?
Yeah, everybody in biochemistry hears the name Otto Warburg.
Right.
The question,
right.
Everybody's using Warburg apparatuses and doing all that kind of stuff. So, but the name, of course, we all heard Warburg, but we never knew what the hell this guy really did and what he was so famous for.
Right.
And he got a Nobel Prize in 1931 for discovery of the respiratory enzyme, which was cytochrome C. Everybody thinks he got a Nobel Prize for cancer. No, he was nominated. And then Hitler said, no German can get a Nobel Prize. So even though he had been nominated, I think two other times, he only had one, but he discovered the key enzyme for oxidative respiration. But he was noticing that all the tumors that he looked at had reduced oxygen consumption and a lot of lactic acid, which what you see when you suffocate something, you get a lactic acid builds up in the bloodstream because you're not respiring anymore. So you get tremendous amount. But when you start breathing, the lactic acid goes away. And Warburg noticed that, and unlike normal cells, cancer cells continue to pump out this lactic acid, even in the presence of 100% oxygen. This was very, very unusual, because normal cells and oxygen produce very little, if any, lactic acid. Yet these cancer cells are still throwing this out. And he looked at hundreds and hundreds of mouse and rat and human cancers, and they all did the same thing. And then he said, there must be something wrong with the mitochondria. Having discovered the oxidative enzyme in the mitochondria, he said there has to be some abnormality in oxidative phosphorylation causing the cancer cells to persist with this fermentation mechanism. And then we did a dive. We did a big lipid study because I'm a lipid biochemist. And we started looking at the critical lipid in the inner membrane of the mitochondria, which is cardiolipin, which controls the function of the electron transport chain. we found every cancer that we looked at had all kinds of abnormalities in the structure and function of this super important lipid that allows the proteins of the electron transport chain to operate efficiently. Mm-hmm. And we published a big paper. We have direct evidence supporting Otto Warburg's theory of a mitochondrial problem being responsible for the fermentation. This went over like a lead balloon in the cancer field. Everybody thinks cancer is a genetic disease, of course, and they never heard of what the hell a cardiolipid is. What the hell is cardio? What's a cardiolipid? They didn't even heard. They didn't know.
What's a cardiolipid? And what's the mitochondria? Yeah, I remember in fifth grade, powerhouse of the cell, That's it. Like, what else is there?
No, so that what they argued was that, Warburg was completely wrong. Cancer cells can take in as much oxygen as normal cells, and all normal cells proliferating will produce lactic acid. There's nothing special about what Warburg had said, and therefore he was... And also, they were all convinced that oncogenes were causing the problems in the mitochondria. So their idea was cancer was a genetic disease, the indoctrinated, brainwashed view that the entire cancer field has and still had and still has, that cancer is a somatic disease of somatic mutations, oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, and, you know, oncogenes, HIF-1-alpha, MYC, and all these things, they're the ones that make the tumor want to use fermentation rather than, so it was teleological arguments thrown in there. It was like a big mess. And then Sidney Winehouse, who was the head of the National Cancer Institute back in the 50s, said Warburg was completely wrong because we have all of these tumors that suck in oxygen just as readily as normal cells. And what they did was they piled all together rat tumors, mouse tumors, and human tumors, and did an average of all of them. And when you do that, the average of the tumors from those organisms and the normal tissues, they all look the same. You got to compare mouse with mouse, rat with rat, human with human. You can't bunch them all together. Mm. And it was a very interesting thing because the field ran off the cliff looking for genes after the Watson and Crick discovery of the structure of DNA. And it was much excitement about, and then they found broken chromosomes in cancer. And they said, "Oh, this is the avenue. This is where it's at. Cancer cells are out of control because of these mutations." Mm-hmm. And you could now quantify the mutations and link it to the different cancers. And so Warburg was pretty much left behind. It was confusing.
Why? I know he was an esoteric person. He had a different style than most. Somehow survived in Germany as a Jew.
Yeah.
Understanding is because Hitler had a particular interest in cancer because of with his mother.
Yeah.
Why did his work die until you brought it to light?
Well, it's true because when I first got into Warburg, I saw his seminal 1956 paper, and at that time it had 400 citations, which wasn't much for the first discovery of the origin of cancer. I would think.
Right.
So
right.
The Hanahan and Weinberg papers that came out in the year 2000. And in 2011, have over 75,000 citations describing cancer as a genetic disease. And Warburg was describing cancer as a metabolic disease, mm-hmm. a problem with the oxidative phosphorylation. So, you know, I started to go back in the history of biochemistry of cancer, and all the controversy about the oxygen consumption and the lactic acid production. Most of the people supported at that time what Warburg was saying, with the exception of a few who had some serious and valid questions that were not—it was not possible to answer at that particular time. And no one knew about our discovery that glutamine is fermented along with the glucose. And this today is still not known or accepted by the majority of people that work in cancer metabolism. They all know glutamine is a major fuel for cancer, but they think it's respired, not fermented. Wrong. It's fermented. We have the direct evidence, the strongest evidence to support that. And Warburg knew nothing about the glutamine issue. So they were saying, some cancer cells can grow like crazy without glucose. How do you explain that, Warburg? And they're driving the glutamine, they're fermenting the glutamine, which he didn't know anything about at the time. So, but anyway, it was a big bag. He said, she said, this company, that, all these things. And they all ran off chasing genes. And then the Genome Atlas and all of these things and said, we're going to cure cancer once we find the key driver gene mutations that are leading to the dysregulated cell growth. So the National Cancer Institute, actually the NCI was working pretty much independently on these problems up until 1984 when because Nixon came out in 1971 saying we need to cure cancer. We have the war. He declared the war on cancer, mm-hmm. just like Johnson declared the war on poverty. So whenever you have a war, then you can have a battle and you can feel like you're fighting something. So we had the war on cancer started in 1971, pushed by Mary Lasker, who was an advocate for the cancer industry at that time. But the progress wasn't good. At 19, you know, people are saying, geez, the NIH is spending all this money and time. And you haven't found the cure yet. So
right.
the way we're going to find the cure is we're going to invite the pharmaceutical industry into the labs at the National Cancer Institute with the hope of accelerating the search for the cure. This is unbelievable. So you let the fox into the hen house in 1984.
Right.
Where the mission was not to cure cancer, was to make money as long as you could on pushing the every now and then a new hot thing didn't work. In the meantime, everybody's making money hand over fist on these new drugs, the angiogenesis drugs, the immunotherapy drugs, the immuno-oncology, anti-angiogenic. Everybody's all excited about all this stuff. And all we got for is more dead cancer patients. And right. and that's clear. Right today, we have just about 1,700 people a day dying from cancer in the United States a day. It's over 600,000 a year. And then when you break it down to hour, we got about 70 people an hour dying from cancer in the United States. And we spend billions and billions of dollars searching for the precision drug that's going to target the mutation on the cancer cell and all this kind of crap. So
I said quite a few things, yeah. and let's unpack some of it. You've said in generalized cancer, I think we would agree that not all cancers are the same, because not all prostate cancer is the same. So if not all prostate cancer is exactly the same,
no.
maybe not all cancer is the same. I'll pause there and let you speak on that.
Yeah, that's not, we've tested this. Okay.
So all cancers are the same.
No, they're, in terms, put it this way. All yeah. cancers are driven by a fermentation metabolism. That's their common phenotype, no matter what kind of cancer it is.
Can you expand on that? Fermentation metabolism. So most of our listeners are self-health advocates. They're not practitioners or scientists. So
right.
let's break that down a little bit.
Okay. So what I mean by that is they get energy without oxygen. And that's mm-hmm. the common phenotype characteristic of all cancer cells. They can't grow without using fermentation, which is a non-energy-making energy ATP synthesis without oxygen. That's one of the unique characteristics of cancer.
All cancer.
We haven't found one that we have. I have a $100 bill in my pocket, and I've been asking my students for the last 5 years, show me a cancer cell that can grow without fermentation. And so far, we have not yet found one. And I'll offer it to any one of your listeners. I'll be happy to relinquish a $100 bill if anybody, and that includes prostate cancer. Those cancer cells cannot grow without the fermentation of glucose and glutamine, period. And I had some oncologists, some of my friends actually, who told me, I don't believe it, prostate cancer is different from other cancers. And I said, I have some clear studies here showing that the mitochondria in prostate cancer is abnormal structurally. And in evolutionary biology, we know structure determines function. And we know prostate cancers can't live without certain fermentable fuels. And he says, I don't think that's true. So my colleague, George Yu, is an oncologist in prostate cancer. He says, I have cancer patients coming into my clinic all the time. I says, George, take some tissue from them, because he works with colleagues at Johns Hopkins. And I said, why don't you turn it over to the, like, because you can't see mitochondria without an electron microscopy. So you have to have an electron microscopy suite to really see what a mitochondria looks like in a prostate mm-hmm. or any cancer for that matter. So I had done a big dive on this, and I took years to go through all the electron microscopy work, because when that was hot in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, a lot of these guys were not asking fundamental questions. They were just looking at structural stuff. And I saw all these electron microscopy of all these different cancers with abnormalities in the number structure, and even functional assays were abnormal. And I looked at prostate cancer too. And I had a couple of papers there from prostate cancer. George said, I don't believe it. Oh, what the hell? I've looked at that. Oh, no, they didn't do it right. So I said, okay. So he sends his prostate cancer tissue to Johns Hopkins, and they come back with some beautiful, beautiful slides showing abnormal mitochondria in the prostate cancer. And then he said, now I believe you. You have to see the evidence. And not only that, we saw lipid droplet accumulation. All major cancers have lipid drop accumulation in the cytoplasm because the mitochondria are defective and they can't use lipids. And we saw the same thing in the prostate cancer. They can't use lipids, so they store them as lipid droplets in the cytoplasm. This is exactly what you'd expect. Finally, he says, okay, it's like, you know, I've seen it all. I believe it now because I have seen it on my own patient's tissue. Now he says, okay, now I agree. So I did all this stuff. I looked at prostate cancer. I looked at brain cancer, colon cancer, bladder cancer, breast cancer. You go up and down, even the blood cancers. All the blood cancers have defective oxidative phosphorylation. So now we know.
When you say defective oxidative phosphorylation, that involves the mitochondria. Expand on that a little bit, because it's a very key, important concept.
Yeah, but well, in the mitochondria, we have cristae. These are the infolding of the inner mass. That's why the mitochondria is a beautiful structure. It has all these stripes, beautiful stripes in the inside of the mitochondria. It's a bean shape, but it's actually like a spaghetti network. It fuses and fizzes. It's a second organism living inside of our cells. It has its own DNA. It actually controls the quiescent, differentiated state of the cell. It controls the life cycle of that cell, controls the cyclins, all from the proton motive gradient in the cristae of the mitochondria. Okay, so when you look at mitochondria of cancer cells, you often find ghost mitochondria. Cristae aren't there. So how the hell are you going to get energy from oxygen if the damn structure itself is not there? So in order to stay alive, it has to ferment. Because Warburg said a very important thing. He said, if you damage oxidative phosphorylation, that is the way the mitochondria generate massive amounts of energy from oxygen. If you damage that too acutely, you will kill the cell and it can never become a cancer. In order to get cancer, you have to chronically interfere with oxidative phosphorylation. Energy through oxygen, bit by bit, year by year, months by, and eventually, every time this inefficiency is introduced or hit the cancer cell, it starts to upregulate. It's a very interesting thing. The mitochondria in the cell controls what goes on in that cell. And if something happens to the energy production, the mitochondria immediately, almost instantaneously, signals the nucleus of the cell to turn on transporters for glucose and glutamine. And what those transporters, see, if you have a highly efficient energy system and that energy system becomes slightly less efficient, you have to make up the energy because otherwise the cell's going to die. So we evolved to upregulate fermentation dramatically when oxidative phosphorylation is interrupted. And the best example of this is when people have heart attacks, cardiac arrest, all of a sudden in your bloodstream, you see massive amounts of lactic acid and succinic acid. And those are the two waste products of fermentation metabolism from glucose and glutamine. The cancer field never put that together. I put that together. So with some other work as well. So what's happening is that the cancer cell is constantly making lactic acid and succinic acid because the organelle needed to generate efficient energy is inefficient. So once that happens, the organelle that controls the life cycle and state of dormancy and differentiation loses the grip. And the cell, driven by fermentation, falls back on the way cells were before oxygen came into the atmosphere 2.5 billion years ago. We had a lot of things living on the planet before we had oxygen, and they were all fermenters. There was no oxygen, so you couldn't use oxygen to generate energy. So there was a transfer of phosphate groups from organic molecules, and you got ATP. But those cells grew uncontrolled. They were no control. Cancer is cell division out of control. The cells that existed on the planet before oxygen were cell division out of control. And they would die when there was no more fermentable fuels. That's the way they just grew. If there was plenty of fermentation fuel, they would grow and divide uncontrollably. And as that fuel disappeared, they would die. The cancer cells are simply falling back on these ancient fermentation pathways. And the organelle controlling the cell cycle is gone. So you don't self-destruct like apoptosis, programmed cell death. No, we can't do that because the organelle controlling the kill switch is broken. So these cells are just growing out of control and they're creating an environment that the body looks at as a wound. Wow, what's going on with these cells? They're damaging the microenvironment. So our immune system comes in to look at why these cells are growing out of control. Because that's, if I stab myself, I would get a wound and the immune system would come in to kill bacteria. And so they throw growth factors and all these things to try to facilitate wound healing. which is in cancer, is the wrong Conte. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. But these mindless immune cells have no clue. They just respond by evolutionary programs. So they're throwing gasoline on top of this fire. Normally, they would heal the wound and cause a scar, and everything they would leave, and the microenvironment would be healed. But if you're throwing out lactic acid and succinic acid, it serves as a cue to the immune system to say, we got an unhealed wound here. So they come in, and all of a sudden, these cancer cells start growing more and more. And what happens is the immune system is designed to fuse with, if you don't do what we were designed to do, we actually fuse with each other. We can fuse with all these cells to facilitate wound healing, which then creates the metastatic cancer, because these cancers that start initially are not metastatic. Most of them are not metastatic because they don't have the cap. Macrophages are the protector cells in our body. They are like the state militia. You get something wrong, they come right out of the bloodstream, they go into cure, they go into manage. All of a sudden, these cells are coming into this cancerous growth, thinking that it's a wound. They're doing what their mindless program is to do to heal wounds, but it's in the wrong context, causing these cells to grow more. And once that fusion happens, you have bad mitochondria now in a genome of a macrophage, which already is genetically programmed to intravasate, extravasate the bloodstream and spread all over the body. So basically what a cancer cell, metastatic cancer cell, is a rogue macrophage. And we know what they need. They need glucose and glutamine. And we did that. We interrogated all these cells. So once you know the biology of the system and the mitochondria gradually losing control of the differentiated state, these cells now morph back into this dysregulated growth driven by ancient fermentation pathways. And we've clearly shown that Warburg clearly showed that glucose is fermented to lactic acid, even in the presence of oxygen. Well, that shouldn't be. If you have normal, healthy mitochondria, that lactic acid should stop. And when the person has a heart attack, and you see lactic acid and succinic acid going through the roof, and all of a sudden somebody gives them heart resuscitation, they start breathing, lactic acid and succinic acid go away. Why? Because the cells are respiring again. But cancer cells are locked into this fermentation because the very organelle controlling that is dysfunctional.
Well, fascinating. This is a mini masterclass on how cancer develops and progresses.
Yeah.
And once again, to be clear, your research, your perspective, this is all cancer cells. They all function in a very similar fashion.
This is a difficult pill for the field to swallow.
Yeah, I think so.
Because they look at the cancer genetics. Well, prostate cancer has a different genetics than the colon, the breast, and all. But they're all fermenters. Forget about the genes.
The same fermenting process of glucose and glutamine.
Yes, and some prostate cancers ferment glutamine more than glucose. You won't see it on a PET scan. So you can explain all this stuff, and
that the Warburg effect and effects of the mitochondria that most people present is example of when you do an FDG, that's a glucose PET scan, cancer cells show up. That is not the case in prostate cancer.
So
FDG PET scans are not great for prostate cancer. And you're saying because there's more mutation of glutamine and not glucose?
I think that could be the case. But when we look at prostate cancer, they are fermenting lactic acid and succinic acid. And besides, the prostate cancer cells in the prostate gland itself are kind of indolent. They already look like they're half cancer anyway. So, you know, it's a kind of an unusual organ. And, you know, and when we looked at it, but we look at the mitochondria because that's ultimately the key to what the core of what the problem is. If I saw normal looking mitochondria in prostate cancer, growing in vivo, and then I would look at them in culture, and they didn't need glucose and glutamine to grow, then I would say this is a violation of the Warburg theory and our understanding of how cancer arises, and we have not found that. You can take any cancer cell, prostate cancer, and grow it in the culture dish. If it doesn't have glucose or glutamine, it's going to die, and you give it glucose and glutamine back. And then, as you said, some people say, oh, no, prostate cancer uses fatty acids. Oh yeah, as long as glucose and glutamine are in the dish, you take the glucose and glutamine, leave the fatty acids, they're dead. Now, what's interesting is fatty acids are uncoupling agents. This was known for years in biochemistry. What does that mean? Okay, when you give fatty acids, you actually uncouple the mitochondrial membrane, allowing protons to move into the matrix, dissipating energy through oxidative phosphorylation. So, normally you would die, but if there's glucose and glutamine in there, you can actually facilitate the use of glucose and glutamine by fatty acids. So when people grow the cancer cells and glucose and glutamine, give them the, oh, look at the prostate, look at the cells growing much faster with the fatty acids. Yeah, because they're uncoupling, forcing more glucose and glutamine, driving the dysregulated cell growth. You got to know the biochemistry of lipid biochemistry, all this, to put this together. But we've known in bio, the problem is, in biochemistry, all of this stuff is clear. But nobody's, when you go to the cancer field, it's like they never heard of any of this stuff.
Mm.
They've been chasing genes. They've been chasing the wrong things, and therefore they're not focusing on the right things. And what's the result? 1,700 people a day are dying because the field is focusing on the, and where do the genes come from? The mutations. When the mitochondria oxidative phosphorylation is defective, they throw out reactive oxygen species, ROS, which are carcinogenic and mutagenic. So the mutations we see in the nucleus that everybody's focused on are downstream effects of the dysfunctional oxidative phosphorylation in the mitochondria. Unbelievable.
Fascinating.
It is believable because I did the studies myself.
Once again, for clarity purposes, everybody says, well, you're genetically predisposed to X cancer. And you're saying there is no such thing, that is only if you're mitochondrially, a word that I just made up, I don't know if it's a good word, you're more mitochondrially higher risk of developing prostate cancer. So this thing that we do, that I do, family medical history, genetic predisposition.
No,
are we looking at the wrong tree?
No. You have to incorporate that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to incorporate that. Now there are genes that put us at risk for cancer. They're not primary causes. We call secondary causes, like BRCA1. You hear about the
and BRCA2 and prostate cancer. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. We've checked all those mutations. Every known genetic germline. That's not somatic now.
Yeah.
There's two kinds of mutations: the ones that are acquired during the cancer process, and the germline mutations that are risk factors.
Passed on by your parents.
But none of them, there is primary and secondary risk factors. A primary risk factor is every time you have that, you will manifest the condition. An example is like Huntington's disease. I use that because anyone that would have the mutation in Huntington will develop a brain degeneration and dementia and all this kind of stuff. There's no exceptions. Cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs disease. These are primary causes of the phenotype of the disorder. We have never found a germline risk factor that's 100% penetrant, meaning that everybody who has that gene will manifest the phenotype. And we have never seen that. The highest one was Li-Fraumeni, which was about 80% penetrant. The BRCA ones and these things are about 45 to 60% penetrant, meaning about 40% of people having the mutation never develop the tumor. But everyone that has the tumor has mitochondrial defect. So they have abnormalities in the mitochondria. Why the mutation causes a mitochondrial defect in that person, and the same person has another gene, and this person doesn't have it, we don't know the answer to that. It could be a suppressor gene or whatever it is. All we know is that—
Epigenetics?
Epigenetics is a term that people speak about only because it's a very complicated thing and nobody can challenge them on anything. Oh yeah, it's epigenetics. Okay, well, maybe it is, maybe it's not. And the most powerful thing, epigenetic system in the cell, is the mitochondria. It controls the way the nuclear genes work.
Correct. So that's sort of what I was alluding to, that maybe there's epigenetic elements to and how it affects the mitochondria, where someone with a genetic risk to a cancer don't have it because they're, in this conversation, their mitochondria is much, let's just keep the language simple, healthier due to epigenetic reasons.
Right. So as I said, when you have dysfunctional mitochondria chronically, oncogenes turn on. Oncogenes will then upregulate the transporters for getting glucose and glutamine in through the glycolysis-glutaminolysis pathways. So they are facilitators of the problem in the mitochondria. So the mitochondria turns on these facilitators, and the mitochondria defect then causes the somatic mutations in the nucleus that you see. So all of this is related to mitochondrial function. And it's very difficult to get cancer if your mitochondria are healthy. That's why we have never found a cancer that has that has normal and functional mitochondria.
How is that measured? I still clinically don't have a good way of measuring healthy or unhealthy, or just measuring the health of mitochondria. Am I missing something? Am I not looking at the right place, or it doesn't exist?
No. It's
without tissue biopsy, of course.
Yeah. Well, tissue biopsy will let you know if there's structural abnormalities. But don't forget, most of the pathologists don't do electron microscopy on the pathology. They just look at how many mitotic figures you have in the tissue to give you some estimate of how malignant it might be. it's low grade, high grade, you know, 1 to 4, these Gleason 9 things. They all have a different quantitative or some estimate of what they see in the biopsy tissue that they...
But they're not looking at mitochondrial health. No, for...
they're just looking at cell proliferation rates and what are you going to get
yeah.
from looking at mitotic figures? Can you give yeah. me some quantitative thing? And that's, you know, purely a judgment call as well. That's yeah. another. I have a big section in my book about how bad yeah. this judgment is. Oh my God!
Yeah, it's all subjective.
I see it. And
the way things are going, and there's already AI involvement in prostate cancer called arterial AI. It's gonna be more effective in figuring out what prostate cancer A and what's the real staging yeah. from this perspective that we're talking about.
For us, it doesn't make any difference because if you pull the plug.
So a Gleason 6 is low risk disease in prostate cancer. A Gleason higher than 6, let's say 9, is very aggressive. Mm. From your perspective, a Gleason 6 and a Gleason 9 is all the same from a mitochondrial perspective, I guess?
I would say the Gleason 6 may have more mitochondrial function than the Gleason 9.
Yeah.
So the Gleason 9 will be more fermentative than the Gleason yeah. 6. So we're banging it on a fermentation. And of course...
Is there a way of quantifying that? And are there any labs or commercial labs that we can look
yeah,
at these things?
You know, this whole thing about liquid biopsy is coming to yeah. be the new thing, yeah. but it's not quite accurate enough right now to be, you know, solid. There might be some false negatives and false positives.
Plus, are they looking at mitochondrial function?
No.
Or I don't get. No, they're not. Right.
They would be looking at certain markers shed from the tumor cell, either from the membranes
yeah.
or from the genome itself.
Right.
You're looking for some particular markers, but you're not going to be looking at. We haven't. So far, there's not enough work on metabolic signatures that you might see in the bloodstream.
I think that could be crucial for a clinician to look at.
We're working to get rid of it so you don't have to do that stuff in the first place.
Good luck with that.
Well, that's the metabolic therapy. That's why we have Guy Tannenbaum and all these other guys that go on these incredible water-only fasts and take the glutamine inhibitors. And if they don't have the tumor, then what are we going to do? You know, if I had prostate cancer and I did metabolic therapy and it went away... And now, the way you know it goes away is that if you do a PET scan in bones, because as you said, when it comes out of the prostate and starts becoming metastatic, you can pick up the lesions outside the prostate gland itself. So when you have prostate cancer that's now in the bones and outside the gland, now you know you have a much less probability of doing well. But we can kill those cells. Those are glutamine dogs like you can't believe. So we can knock them out. I want to make it sound like this is simple, but when you understand the biology, if you really understand 40 years of deep biochemistry on it, what you're seeing is absolutely predictable.
And whether your studies or anything that you can cite, that's it. Look, because we certainly know that your work from a preclinical perspective. Talk about your clinical perspective. I know it's related mostly to glioblastomas and brain cancer.
And breast.
What have you seen?
Breast and lung. And
breast and lung as well.
And prostate.
All
of them. So, and who's collecting the
patients? But you've written mostly, I've missed it. I haven't seen you write or anyone from your group write about prostate cancer and ketogenic diet.
I wrote a big puff piece for Nature on prostate cancer.
Okay.
For Nature.
When was that?
That was like 2 years ago. It was two groups started, Steve Friedland's group. And there was another group. Steve is out at USC, I think, or UCLA. He's been working on the metabolic management of prostate gland cancer for quite a number of years.
Oh, Steve Friedland. Yes, he has.
Yeah.
He's a urologist.
Right.
At UCLA.
Yes.
He's had people on he's had people on a very carb, about 20 grams a day, which, by the way, broccoli alone is 10 grams of carbs. So
yeah, well, this is the thing, but he's not hammering the glutamine. So once you start hammering that glutamine, the results are going to be far better, and you don't have to be persecuting yourself with this stuff.
Now, let me ask you this: what you're suggesting, correct me if I misinterpret anything, is leave the glutamine out. Well, anytime you have anything that's a protein, particularly any animal products, but even things that are not animal
glutamine acid. not a protein.
Correct. So when you're eating a protein, most proteins, yeah, they contain glutamine.
Yes.
Glutamine is an essential nutrient.
Yeah.
Is it essential amino acid? I believe it is one of the 8 or 9.
No, it's not essential.
It's not essential. So your body can make what it needs.
Yeah.
And it's essential for multiple things: immune system, brain function, the aligning of the gut. Most people are actually oftentimes prescribe glutamine for gut health and things like that.
Absolutely.
So, A, are you suggesting that we should stay away from glutamine at all costs? Certainly supplementation, but even foods that are high in glutamine. And B, what do we do with the healthy elements of glutamine? Or is it just something the body makes because it's not essential?
Well, that's why we wrote the Press Pulse therapeutic strategy for managing cancer. And Dr. George Yu, who's a prostate cancer oncologist, is one of the authors on the paper. So along with Joe Maroon.
He's out of Hopkins?
He's out of Annapolis, but he works out of Hopkins as well. He has a lot of colleagues that work with him at Johns Hopkins. George Yu, doc, you see it on the page. He does mostly prostate cancer. He's one of the co-authors on the paper. But what we did is we have to press glucose down because the body can switch over to ketones to replace glucose. That's what we did with the epilepsy. That's how we knew all that stuff. So you wouldn't go unconscious. You could push blood sugars down really, really low as long as ketones are there to give the brain the alternative energy. So,
but do we achieve? So is the goal to reach to a ketogenic level that you can measure? You could do that either through a ketogenic diet or fasting. Those are the two methods there. Or is it unrelated to ketogenesis and just related to keeping the glutamine down and the glucose down?
Well,
do we need to be at a ketogenic, which is measurable through strips and things? So do we want that to be, is that the goal?
The goal is two steps. Number one, you bring the patient into nutritional ketosis, which is a GCAG, glucose ketone index, which we published, a quantitative measure to allow cancer patients. I did it for cancer patients, but now I see all these young, healthy guys all wanting to get low GKI because their mitochondria get super healthy when they're burning ketones. So you said, how do I keep my mitochondria healthy? You burn the ketones. And
exercise, yes?
Exercise, absolutely. Exercise and ketones, this is the normal state of humans. We existed in nutritional ketosis for the most of our existence on the planet. So we're just bringing ourselves back to this new state. And of course, the tumor cells start to grow very slowly. Some of them will die. But then we pulse, just like you said, Gio. You can't be too aggressive with the glutamine. It's so essential. So we pulse it. We just give small doses at strategic times while holding the bar on the low glucose. So you hit the tumor super sensitive to the targeting of the glutamine. The immune cells just slow down. They don't die when you target their glutamine. The immune cells will just become somewhat paralyzed, like comatose but they're not dead. The tumor cells die. So you got to pull the drug off and allow the immune system to recover to pick up the dead corpses that are dead from the low glucose and the targeting the glutamine. And then, so what you have is the tumor goes down, you pull the glutamine back and the glutamine targeting and the tumor grows just a little bit more and then you hit them again. So you're allowing the body to recover and rejuvenate between the glutamine pulses, the glutamine drug pulsing. And the tumors just get hammered. And you take this aggressive tumor, you either get rid of it or you bring it into a very dormant, indolent kind of a state. But this is, again, dosage, timing, and scheduling. This is where we are today in eventually having the most successful opportunity to manage cancer. How do we schedule time and pulse this dosage? At what dosage, timing, and scheduling is maximally appropriate for killing tumor cells while maintaining the health of the gut, the health of the immune system, the urea cycle, and all of the things you said are important? You really need to know general body physiology. You need to know biochemistry, and you need to know how bodies respond individually to these challenges. And this is why each person becomes their own control, because these dosage, timing, and scheduling have to be tweaked differently for each person depending on their physiological condition. That's why we can't throw thousands of people into a clinical trial and give them the same thing. It's not going to work. Every person has to be judged on their own blood work, on their own physiology, their own health, and then we design the doses, timing, and scheduling and how we do this. So normally we take the patients, not me because I'm not a physician, But my colleagues, we bring them onto a very low carbohydrate diet for 10 to 14 days. And then we use the GKI, the glucose ketone index.
Is that through fasting or through just a high fat diet?
A zero carb diet. Doesn't even have to be high fat. You can eat fish, you can eat meat, eat small amounts of vegetables. Your body,
again, all these things have carbs. All vegetables have
very little. You're not talking a lot. You're using the GKI as a quantitative measure to determine when you hit the zone, which is 2.0 or below. So when the patient...
The GKI are the strips that people can purchase even online, right? Amazon?
Yeah, you can get... It's called Keto Mojo. And don't forget...
Yeah, Keto Mojo, right.
The field is moving rapidly for Free Libra, these blood sugar monitors that will just stick on your arm. You don't have to be poking your finger anymore. And I understand that the industry is starting to make some sort of Free Libra for ketones as well. So
Free Libra is called?
Yeah, well, that's what the name of the glucose monitor is called right now. If they call it Free Libra, it's a... I think they're not... They used to be needed a prescription, but I think you're going to be able to buy them in the pharmacies.
Yes. And you'll be able to do the... Okay, so it's not measuring ketones, it's measuring blood... Yeah, there are a few companies that... Dexcom is another. There are a few companies that measure blood glucose.
The thing about Keto Mojo is most of these glucose meters give it in deciliter, milligram per deciliter or deciliter. And the ketones are in millimolar. So you have to divide the glucose by deciliter by 18, and then you get the millimolar value, and then you can do the division to get your GKI value. So Keto Mojo so people don't even have to take out the pen and pencil and do the calculation.
Right.
They just
press
the button, it gives you the number.
So, it's a good product, yeah.
Yeah. So once you get into the 2.0 and below, now you know you've gradually transitioned the body slowly to this new metabolic state, allowing your brain and physio... I'm telling you, it's addicted to glucose. It's not easy. Going from
It takes about a week to adapt. Yeah. You don't feel well as a result of your brain adapting to using ketones for energy and not glucose. I tell you, you feel flu, like you have the flu or...
Well, that's if you do it the wrong way. There's a right way to do it too. You can do it on a nice big bone-in ribeye as well. You know, you just got to know how to do it.
God, you're killing my plant-based doctors who are, who I've had on, Dean Ornish, for example.
I don't want to...
You're causing problems.
That's their problem. That's not my problem. You know, you want to get it. You want to manage your cancer. That's your choice.
Right.
No one on a banana is not going to help you. You know. But listen, vegans can get into these zones too. They've got to be chewing on stuff all day long. You know, I mean, it's not like we didn't evolve to be eating plants alone. Let's be honest. We have to go back to our evolutionary existence.
Wow. That is an area that, I'm always in conversation. It's almost like religious affiliations, right?
Oh, yeah. But that's only because we're all fat and happy today. During the Paleolithic period, the vegans would have been extinct. Let's put it that way. Not that I have anything against vegans. I mean,
do it. If you're going to do it the right way, getting enough protein without the gluten.
Yeah, I mean, I have...
By the way, if you're vegan, by definition, your glutamine intake, your sugar intake, glucose intake may be very high, actually. Oh. Oftentimes it is, actually.
Yeah.
But your glutamine intake might be really low just by you're consuming less protein, which probably is another problem.
Well, exercise will also lower glutamine. So you can lower glutamine by
interesting.
Yeah.
How is that? I don't know that I knew that.
Yeah, that was done by George Cahill, a good friend of mine who passed away. He was the head of the Joslin Diabetes Center down here in Boston. So he and I would talk for hours and hours about all this stuff because he did a lot of these basic studies down here in Boston. And he said exercise lowers blood glutamine because the liver's taking it up and they're using it for other things. So it's in the... But you
fascinating.
You can't get down really to the lowest levels without a little push from one of these glutamine inhibitor drugs. And you got to use it very strategically and very carefully. Otherwise, you're going to damage your gut. You're going to damage something. So again, you have to know a little bit about human physiology and what's good for one person. And I don't want to say that vegetarians can't do this. If they get a low GKI on a vegetarian meal, and then you come in with the glutamine targeting drugs in the right strategic way, they're going to respond just as well as the carnivore guys. It's just whatever your body is more capable of doing to get into the low to the GKI value. I'm just saying we did not evolve to eat plants only. I'm just saying that humans will eat anything that walks, crawls, or flies on this planet. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
You'll dig up and eat the tubers. And I mean, you have to go back to our existence. But we're not the, we, anybody, people always ask me, what can I eat? I don't know. Eat whatever the hell you want. If you get a low GKI, then you're in the right zone.
If I, period, end of story. So what we're trying to ultimately accomplish is to have a low GKI.
Yeah.
Is that short term, long term?
Well,
let's say I have a low GKI to this week, next week, not too low. Do we know, like, for how long? Is it forever that we need to have a low GKI? What's your guess on that?
We published the GBM patient, Pablo Kelly, who had a GBM, came to me. We have 5 years of GKI measurements daily, 5 years of daily measurements. Can you believe it? So we were able to predict these ratios and on how patients responded to the cancer. So we were able to see, using non-invasive imaging, to see how GKIs could be linked to how fast your cancer grows. So now don't say, you know, people say, oh, I get low GKI. You know, if you do exercise and get your GKI down, some people the cancer goes away. Other people, it becomes remarkably indolent, and then it's open to attack by surgery. So you can just debulk it, remove it. You look at it, oh, 6 months go by, a year goes by, the damn thing is still there. I see this light up or whatever it is by some imaging, but it's not going anywhere. It's not getting bigger. It's not getting smaller. It's just there. So
not bothering anyone.
In Pablo's case, when he had it debulked, he had an inoperable tumor that's now been operated on 3 times. You got to love it. So, you know, these guys, inoperable. He goes on metabolic therapy. All of a sudden, the damn thing is operable. Now he thought he was out of the woods. Then the physician, neurosurgeon said, I think we got it all this time. And at first they said, oh, if we did it at first, we would never be able to get it all. Now we think he got it all. So he went back a little bit off his traditional metabolic diet. And all of a sudden, we see the damn thing growing again. On the PET scan, on the MRI image in the brain, put the fear of God back into him. All of a sudden, he's back doing the, and all of a sudden, you see the tumor go back.
So what he did and what most people should do is base their diet and their dietary approach or lifestyle, because exercise done right can reduce GKI as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you're trying to hit that 2.0 or less by any means necessary kind of thing?
Yeah. And again, it's everybody's... a lot of folks come in and they've got type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, hypertension. They got all kinds of things. So we do a full workup on the blood and find out how far the markers are from what we would consider normal ranges. And then as we bring the patient more and more into a lower GKI, all of a sudden, triglycerides go down, HDL.
Yeah, everything like
that. Oh, yeah. And then once that patient gets in, now they're open for the glutamine targeting. And one of the drugs that we also work with is embendazole, which is a parasite medication. You know, I love the way it works in this country. You can go to India and get embendazole as a deworming kind of a drug. And you pay about 50 cents for the tablet. And in our country, once we realize it has an effect on cancer, it's now $300 a tablet. You got to love our system. So
right. So as part of the protocol, so you use embendazole for...
Why? So people say, why the hell are you using embendazole? If you know the biology and biochemistry of parasites, parasites use fermentation metabolism to stay alive.
So it inhibits glutamine?
Yeah. They're fermenting the goddamn glutamine. So
it's a glutamine inhibitor.
Yes.
Embendazole. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and,
so is that the...
And,
is that the...
And they're not, it's blocking glucose and glutamine, both. Now, the problem is it's a mild inhibitor. It's not a big hammer. The Don drug, 6-deoxynorleucine, is the big hammer. That's the one that really shuts the glutamine down. And that's the...
What's it called?
6-deoxynorleucine is called Don, D-O-N. That was used years ago for cancer management in the clinic. But like anything, if you don't know the biology and biochemistry of what the hell you're doing, the outcome is not going to be optimal. So what they were doing was giving patients a large amount of this Don drug, and it was causing a lot of different toxicity to the gut, to the immune system, right? Let's be honest. So they weren't targeting glucose. They weren't putting their patients into low GKI. So they said, oh, this is no good. And you can't make money on it because it can't be patented. So you can't make money on it, using it the wrong way. Okay, we don't want to use it anymore. They shouldn't bring that damn drug back, because now we know how to use it, and it could be a tremendous therapy keeping these cancer patients alive once they're in low GKI. We know what we need to do. It's just that the system doesn't understand what the hell I'm talking about. After a while, you say to yourself, maybe I'm nuts.
So what are some natural ways without Embendazole or Don, just because it's either very expensive in the country or hard to have access to? Is it as simple as find out foods that are high and lower the intake of glutamine, and certainly no supplements with glutamine, and glucose-wise, very low-carb diet? Because even if you consume a plant-based diet with no sugar and no, you know, processed foods, that turns, even if it's a carbs after a certain amount, that turns into sugar as well.
Well,
into glucose.
Again, well, then it'll elevate your GKI. So you're using the GKI as a quantitative measure to know what you can and cannot eat in what zone. And then your knowledgeable oncologist that shouldn't be, know this, would be working with you as an individual and looking at your GKI and non-invasive imaging to see where you are on your checkups and and the patient. And the bottom line is, how do you feel? Oh, the guy said, I feel pretty good. Okay. You know, I'm not suffering from any horrible stuff. What do they use in this, the hormone stuff, this terrible, what do they use for managing prostate cancer?
So advanced prostate cancer, they use androgen deprivation therapy.
That's nuts.
Which is Lupron or, you know, these other things, Baratarone and Bide and all these drugs.
No,
so you do that, chemical castration.
Yeah, that's because you lack knowledge. Okay, anybody who does that to another human being lacks knowledge. So and that's what I talk about. And of course, people get offended, and that's their problem. You know, I'm looking at this stuff from a biochemical angle. I know what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Now, we don't say, oh, we can cure cancer with metabolic therapy. I don't say that. If you can stay alive much longer with a higher quality of life, that's success. If it comes back and eventually kills you 10 years later, you did better than you would have done if you were taking that crazy androgen stuff. You know, and I wrote that in my puff piece. I said that. I said, this is nuts. You can't be doing
it. What? Where did you write that?
I wrote it, like I said, it's in Nature.
The article in Nature. Yeah. Sure, I'm going to pull it.
Yeah, article in Nature. And it was talking about Friedland's work in another group, and they were both using carbohydrate restriction. They were getting very good results, but the problem is they're not targeting the glutamine to get the optimal effect.
Good results. Very, very difficult to stay on such a diet. They were really...
They used the wrong diet. Okay, wrong diet.
They used the Atkins type of diet.
Yeah, well, that's not good either. You can eat whatever you want. Just get your GKI down. You're not going to...
Period, end of story. That's...
Yes.
You could do that through intermittent fasting. I do, for example, the fasting mimicking diet quarter, and my GKI...
And also, you can take some, like my good friend and colleague, Dominic D'Agostino, who's building some ketone supplements.
Yeah.
Can make it a little bit easier for...
Do they taste any better? They used to taste pretty nasty.
Because they're still working on that. Well,
I'm not doing it. No, I'm not doing it. I'll stick to the diet and I'll stick to fasting.
Yeah, well, I agree. And they're making a lot of keto foods. You know, I've tasted some of them. And
Joe Low GKI.
Well, only if you
aim keto bars and keto.
Well, eat one a week.
Peanut butter cups and things, but.
You know, eat one a week and you'll get into the G.
not three a day?
No. You know, when I did that water only fasting to see if I could get to do it, you know, just say it's hard when you just go cold turkey. It's brutal. So these companies always giving me some keto food to test and say what I think and all this kind of stuff. So I had one of these muffins from some company. I can't remember the name. It was the worst damn muffin I ever ate in my life. And it was like eating cardboard, right? Some stuff.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So I tell you, after three days, myself and a good friend, our wives told us, you guys talk, you can't do anything. So I said, okay, I'll try it and see what it was like. After 3 days, man, it was like, you're looking at your pet in a different way, you know? So...
Well, you see your pet walking, you see like a piece of meat or a turkey, you know, medium rare.
Yeah, you see a food commercial come on TV, and that's an important thing you've seen all day.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, I broke my fast eating that muffin, that keto muffin. I'm telling you, man, it was the best muffin I ever ate in my life. I was getting crumbs all over the floor and on the walls.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. When you're hungry, we've been weaned on these hamburgers and chalupas and all this makes it. And now we eat something that's really close to being more natural. We don't want it. So it tastes terrible.
So your view and your mind changes as it relates to food, your cravings go away.
Yeah. So yes, when you say, oh, that ketogenic diet is so unpalatable. Well, Anthony Chaffee and some of these other guys, they eat the bone-in prime ribs, for crying out loud. They get into the low GKI. That's not something.
Yeah, but that's
butter on the top of it.
Isn't that a high-protein diet, and you could go through gluconeogenesis and convert these proteins to glucose?
Yeah, but it's not. You're using the GKI as a measure. So,
period. That's it. Yeah, it always comes down to that.
Yes, it comes down to that. And you know, geez, I ate too much of the bone-in ribeye. Maybe I have to back off a little bit. Maybe I'll have a smaller piece this time than the big ass thing that I ate before. So, and everybody comes to know their own physiology. And you do it with the foods that you like to eat. You just have to eat a little bit less of them until you get to the low GKI. So it doesn't have to be torture. And so
low GKI, for clarity purposes, that is only measuring the fact that you have low glucose creating ketones.
Yes.
Nothing to do with the glutamine.
No, nothing to do with the glutamine.
Is there something to measure glutamine?
Yeah, well, you can measure it in your blood, but the problem is it's the most abundant amino acid in our body.
And that's right.
They're more abundant than anything. But the cancer cells, I would say, and if you exercise, you have a low GKI and you do a lot of good aerobic exercises, you can lower that glutamine down even further. And some people...
But you can't measure it. You can't have a baseline and measure to see...
I'm sure there's technology to do that, but it's not going to be simple for the guy at the house to do. And maybe in the future there will be some way to do this. But again, the bottom line is your tumor growing? Is it not growing? Is it getting smaller? How do you feel? What's your GKI? And then if you take embendazole on top of that, and you start to see greater shrinkage. And as I said, the reason why the parasites, because many people mistake, they say cancer is a parasite. No, parasites and cancer are different species, different altogether. The cancer is coming from a human or a mouse or a rat. The parasite is a different organism infecting these organisms. But the parasite uses the same metabolic pathway, a very similar metabolic pathway as the tumor cell. So if I'm killing the parasite with the, all of a sudden I see the damn tumor's going down. I said, what the hell's going on with that? Nobody could figure it out because we showed they're fermenting glutamine. It's a glutamine fermentation system. They're using mitochondrial substrate level phosphorylation. I don't want to go down to that path. But that's what the mechanism of action of what's happening here. So once you understand that, then you know how to kill these cancer cells. And you can kill them in a variety of ways. This guy did it that way. He did it this way. The bottom line is the damn thing is indolent. It's not growing as fast. And that's ultimately what you're out looking for.
Fascinating. Dr. Seyfried, you've been very generous with your time. It's so much info that I've gathered. My brain is frying right now. I'm going to go look up some of these papers because I've applied many of the concepts. I do believe in the metabolic aspect of cancer, including prostate cancer. I've had very little success with ketogenic diets with patients, maybe because I didn't prescribe it the right way. Yeah. And particularly those that, one of the things that increases the risk of development of prostate cancer and progression once you're diagnosed is high BMI.
Yeah. Yes.
Related to just a lot of body fat. So in those cases, I put them on a ketogenic diet, particularly because I'm very interested in getting a twofer, perhaps.
Yeah.
Whatever it does to the cancer. Never really went hard on the glutamine aspect of things, which is, that's going to be an area I'm really going to look hard at. And I may talk to Friedland and see if he wants to collaborate or something.
I think use Friedman's, he's right with the glucose, no question about it. And the cancer cells can't burn ketones. So that, that's helping the normal cells. Nah, the cancer cells can't use fatty acids or ketone bodies because they're mitochondria defective. So if you can get your patients into a low GKI, then, embendazole, fenbendazole is another one of these things. You can start giving the patients this and see how they respond. And then you have a lot of ways to assess whether you have success or not. So, water only fasting works really well. You should interview Guy Tannenbaum. He's the guy with the advanced prostate cancer who did it all by water only fasting and exercise. So he has he was one unhealthy individual, and now he's much healthier without the prostate cancer.
I will get to them. I have a gentleman that runs a fasting clinic in Fornia that we've been communicating. In any event, North Star.
I know that place.
Yeah, North Star.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to have him on the podcast.
Well, the GKI can get down, and if you can't get it down by the diet you're eating, jump into water only fasting. It'll go down. And the other,
and then how do you keep it down?
Well,
you can't fast forever.
No, you can't. That's why you have to keep your. That's why you have to judge. You can judge for yourself what you should or should not eat. Now you can eat it.
Right.
And this is not supposed to be uncomfortable. You can have the choice. Okay, it's either this or the radiation of the poisonous chemicals, those androgen things you're given. So let the patient make their decision. Let them choose what they would want to do. See what you get.
Yeah, yeah. It becomes very, very tricky because a lot of people have the mentality of, look, I need to do something physical to this, period, end of story. That's just a mentality thing, or just, you know, the system, the medical system.
Yeah.
In my world, so as you know, I'm faculty at NYU. I have an amazing relationship with everyone where if they're going to get their prostate out, they're going to get their prostate out. You know, hormone therapy is always a little tricky for me. I'd rather my patients not be on hormone therapy, but this is part of how they treat advanced prostate cancer. So I'm trying to do other things to help them counter some of the side effects of hormone therapy as we try to do things for their cancer as well.
This is the way it'll work. You have to have some hybrid system. Because the guys doing the androgen stuff are going to feel bad if you told them you don't want to do that anymore. They're going to get like, I make it.
Yeah, right.
This stuff.
You get fired as a patient.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, this is like, this is the system that prevents flexibility. So if you have the rock hard science like I have, and you're not implementing that in the clinic, what's the reason for that? There must be something other than patient outcome that's preventing you from doing this. So patients have to make the decision. Do they should be the ones rattling the cages. The hell, man. I want metabolic therapy. We don't know that. Cancer cells don't need, they use fat. And these guys don't know. So I'll talk to them, you know, and try to educate. Why don't you read the papers? It just gets me frustrated. People, they can do this. I test everything. I did it all. I know what I'm looking at. We've interrogated these cells like you can't believe, even torturing the cells.
Right.
So anyway, I'll let you go, but it was great speaking with you.
Likewise, how can people get in touch? They need to. I don't think you're patients. You made that clear.
Well, I give kits of information out to the cancer patients. I can't tell anybody what to do or what not to do. All I can tell them is if you read this information, you become more knowledgeable than you were. You can ask important questions to your oncologist, and then you get slapped down. That's where they get the slap in the face. Cancer cells, the glucose has nothing to do with cancer cells. Walk out of that guy's office. He's clueless. He has no clue what the hell he's talking about.
So do you have a website where you have a list of papers that people can...
No, it's all open access on the web. So you just put my name, you'll get all the papers out because we publish open access. Anybody who has a computer can read the papers. We get all of our donations from private foundations and philanthropy. We're always excited to know that there are some good people out there that want to see the paradigm changing for the good of humanity. They don't really care whether they're going to make $1 billion on what we're doing. So we just know we're keeping a lot of people alive for a longer period of time. And that's our measure of success, is that guys that should have been dead are walking around. And Brad and Maggie Jones are collecting all of the different cancer patients. I think there's some prostate in there, brain, colon, breast, all what they call stage 4 terminal cancer patients. And they're making a big documentary movie on this, and there'll be a couple of more documentary on our stuff coming out in the future. Some Hollywood people are interested in this. So it's coming. It's coming slowly, but it's happening. It's a paradigm change in the way we're going to manage cancer for the benefit of the way the health. And the other thing, too, is hypertension, as you said, diabetes, all these things start going away with your tumors. And it's just a regeneration of health, keeping your mitochondria healthy.
It's all about the mitochondria.
It's all about the mitochondria. Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Dr. Seyfried. Look, I hope to have you on the audience doesn't know this yet, but I'm hosting a prostate cancer summit that's going to be revolutionary in terms of the kind of speakers that we'll have. And so I hope to have you there, and I'll be in touch with regards to that. And thank you so much for being on. I appreciate all the wealth of information you shared with us.
Oh, thank you very much, Gino. It was very nice to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening, for watching, if you're watching. A great episode with Dr. Seyfried, of course, and I hope you got a lot from it. But I think the future of prostate cancer when we look at it, a lot has to do with the metabolic approach to it for sure. So stay tuned for the research on my end on that regard. So thank you for watching. Much love. Dr. Gio here signing off. I'll talk to you next time.
Our next sponsor partner has a product I use literally every day. I'm talking about AG1. You know, I've been using green powders mixed in drinks for a long time, and it has not always been a great experience, right? The powder clumps up a little bit. It tastes horrible, but you know what? You chug it anyway because it's good for you. AG1 changed the game. In AG1, you have 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source ingredients, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day the right way. This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, and energy to help you recover and focus and help you age successfully. To make it easy, AG1 is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Dr. Gio. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/Dr. Gio to take ownership of your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
And now for a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for general information only, and we're not forming a doctor-patient relationship through this medium. The use of the information and all links associated with this podcast is at the listener's risk and is not to replace medical advice from a physician or a healthcare practitioner. Lastly, thoughts and opinions related to this podcast are my own and may not reflect the views of any institution or organization I'm associated with. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Dr. Gio podcast. You can watch all episodes of this podcast and much more by subscribing to my YouTube channel on youtube.com/GioEspinozaND. If you love what you heard today, you can help by leaving a 5-star review of the podcast on Apple and Spotify, as each review helps us reach more men who are serious about improving their urological health and how to function better with age. And for the latest research and actionable takeaways in the world of men's health and integrative urology, sign up for my newsletter at drgio.com. I'll see you next time.